Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. Russia calls for elections in Syria. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the Kremlin want Syria to prepare for parliamentary and presidential elections as Moscow intensifies its drive to convert its increased clout with Damascus into a political settlement. In comments which mark a shift in Russia's position, Lavrov also said that Russia's Air Force, which has been bombing Islamic militants in Syria since September 30th, would be ready to help Western-backed Free Syrian Army rebels if it knew where they were. The Kremlin, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's strongest foreign ally, has spoken broadly about the need for elections in Syria before, but Lavrov's comments were its most specific call for political renewal yet and came just days after a surprise visit by Assad to Moscow. Lavrov told Russian state TV in an interview broadcast that external players cannot decide anything for the Syrians. He said we must force them to come up with a plan for their country where the interest of every religious, ethnic, and political group will be well protected. Well, the U.S. State Department declined to comment on all this, pointing to what Secretary of State John Kerry had said about Syria in Vienna on Friday.
The United States, I want to emphasize, welcomes support in the fight against Daesh. And if Russia intends to join in that fight, we welcome a constructive role. But targeting moderate fighters doesn't hurt Daesh.
The Russian Foreign Ministry said Lavrov on Saturday phoned John Kerry to discuss organized talks between the Syrian government and the opposition. This is VOA News. Israel and Jordan have agreed to take steps aimed at reducing tensions at one of Jerusalem's holiest sites, known as the Temple Mount to Jews and the Al-Aqsa Mosque to Muslims. U.S. Secretary of State Kerry said that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has agreed to announce that his country fully respects Jordan's role as the custodian of the site, along with the continuation of the long-standing policy of worship at the site, that is, Muslims who pray and non-Muslims who visit. In addition, Mr. Kerry said Israel agrees to a suggestion made by King Abdullah II of Jordan that cameras be installed to provide 24-hour video access to the site. Mr. Kerry was in Amman Saturday to meet with King Abdullah and Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority. He met with Mr. Netanyahu 2 days earlier in Berlin. Record-breaking Hurricane Patricia appeared to leave remarkably little damage as it moved rapidly inland over mountainous western Mexico early Saturday and weakened to tropical depression status, though authorities warned it still could cause deadly floods and mudslides. Patricia, which peaked as the strongest hurricane on record in the Western Hemisphere, made landfall Friday on a sparsely populated stretch of Mexico's Pacific coast as a Category 5 storm, avoiding direct hits on the resort city of Puerto Vallarta and the major port city of Manzanillo. There were reports of some flooding and landslides, but no word of fatalities or major damage as the storm pushed across the inland mountains while bypassing the metropolis of Guadalajara overnight. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for a bomb attack in Bangladesh that killed one and wounded up to 100 at a Shiite Muslim religious procession in Dhaka. The monitor group, SITE, SITE, said Saturday that the Islamic State has released a statement saying soldiers of the group in Bangladesh set off the explosions during what its statement called polytheistic rituals. The attack took place Saturday while worshippers were gathered at the main Shiite Muslim shrine in the capital to mark the festival of Ashura. It commemorates the death of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Hundreds of South Koreans crossed the border into North Korea Saturday for the second round of family reunions this week, connecting with families separated by the political division from the Korean War. The most elderly of the South Koreans were assisted onto buses, taking them to a resort for a closely monitored 12-hour meeting with their long-lost relatives. The Korean Red Cross, which helped organize the reunion, had warned the South Koreans not to criticize North Korea. Neither Pyongyang nor Seoul allow their citizens to exchange phone calls or letters with relatives on the opposite side of the border. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We have talked to various candidates, and they are all very positive that things are going to go well.
The head of the East African Community Poll Observer Mission urges Tanzanians to maintain peace.
Les élections présidentielles qui sont censées se tenir.
He says the presidential election was tarnished by irregularities even before the first votes could be cast.
A presidential candidate pulls out of the general election in Ivory Coast, saying conditions are unfair for anyone challenging President Alassane Ouattara.
The real question is how best to get these four doses in and at times when we don't normally have a health care interaction with the child.
And a World Health Organization advisory group recommends continued clinical trials of a promising malaria vaccine to test its efficacy and safety. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. African election observers are upbeat about Sunday's scheduled elections in Tanzania, saying meetings with stakeholders in the country have been positive. Arthur Moody Awori, leader of the East African Community Observer Mission, said his team has received assurances of readiness in meetings with the National Electoral Commission of Tanzania, political parties and civil society organizations. The former Kenyan vice president told me that there is need for citizens to remain peaceful and abide by the electoral laws as they prepare to vote in the presidential, parliamentary and local elections.
So right now, we first of all have talked to all the stakeholders. We have talked to various candidates, and they are all very positive that things are going to go well. We have talked to the National Election Commission, and they have assured us that all the matters that go into making the citizens cast their votes are all in place. We have talked to the security officers, and they too have told us that they are ready to ensure that there is security everywhere. So these are some of the things we have observed.
Your Excellency, Mr. Awori, some have said that this election is going to be the most competitive so far. So they are expressing concern about whether the Electoral Commission will be truly independent. But so far that you have met all the stakeholders, including the Electoral Commission and the political parties, what was your observation?
We have this evening, we saw a rally which was being addressed by the outgoing president of the country, and people, those who are going about their business, they went about their business. Those who were interested in listening, they were at the place, and things seemed to be quite well. From there, as we drove on, we saw another very big group near a church, and they had gathered at the church to pray for a peaceful election. So what we have observed is that the assurances that we have been given, we hope that things will go well.
What areas, what cities will the EAC Poll Observer Mission be covering as part of your mission to monitor the election?
Well, you know, casting the vote is the last part of an election. It's with education, civic education, with the people to know what is the importance of election. It goes with the question of the registration. That they have got to register in order to vote. The civic education shows them that they must register where they will easily vote. So we have followed all that, and we have talked to the people. We have seen what is happening, and we understand the observation is simply that for the first time, this is going to be a very competitive election. And when it is competitive, then there is a lot of excitement.
What would be your message to the people of Tanzania ahead of the election?
I think my message, first and foremost, is to keep the peace. Secondly, to observe the laws of the country. And thirdly, to really appreciate the importance of that vote, that they have listened to all the candidates, that they have got to choose the candidate who will fulfill their aspirations and who will be able to bring their understanding, their interest to fruition. So my message to them, accept the verdict of what the people have said and then move on, because as an East African, we are here observers to see that there is good governance and that eventually we in East Africa will have a political federation.
Former Kenyan Vice President Moody Awori is the leader of the East African Community Observer Mission. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Still in Tanzania, the people head to the polls on Sunday, and the election is the primary topic of conversation these days. Voters will determine whether to keep ruling party CCM in power or if they will instead choose the opposition party CHADEMA. Some are calling CHADEMA the party of the youth. But is it? VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig has more from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Six contestants are now left trying to thwart incumbent president Alassane Ouattara's bid for a second term. Sunday's vote is seen as an important test for the country following post-election violence 5 years ago that left at least 3,000 people dead. Here in Abidjan, the commercial capital, the State Electoral Commission has erected giant billboards exhorting everyone to vote. Preventing somebody from voting is anti-democratic, the message says. Everybody is free to choose the candidate they want. Some opposition candidates do not believe the elections will be free and fair. Former Prime Minister Charles Konan Bani pulled out of the race on Friday.
Les élections présidentielles qui sont censées se tenir.
He says the presidential election was tarnished by irregularities even before the first votes could be cast, and that this unfair process is what prompted him to withdraw. Bani is the third of Ouattara's challengers to drop out over the past few weeks. All claim that the Electoral Commission is biased in favor of the incumbent president and that the list of voters has many double entries, a potential source of vote fraud. The Electoral Commission said Friday it has investigated those allegations but found no conclusive evidence of unfair conditions. On the other side of this city of nearly 5 million people, Ouattara presided at his final campaign rally Friday. Famous Ivorian artist, fireworks over the city, the last rally surely was meant to impress. President Ouattara seemed unfazed by Bani's withdrawal.
Combien de candidats il reste?
How many candidates are there now? Ouattara asked. He's calling for a massive turnout by his supporters, and he wants a first-round knockout victory in Sunday's balloting. The Electoral Commission has accredited 7,000 local and international monitors to observe voting across the country. Results of Sunday's ballot are expected within 48 hours. Emily Yop for VOA News in Abidjan.
We apologize for the technical hitch. That was a story by Emily Yop from Ivory Coast. But we go to the Tanzania election again, and Tanzania's head to the polls Sunday, and the election is the primary topic of conversation these days. Voters will determine whether to keep ruling party CCM in power or if they will instead choose the opposition party Chadema. Some are calling Chadema the party of the youth, but is it? VOA's East Africa correspondent Jill Craig has more from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Sorry for that again. We are experiencing a little technical hitch here. But in recent years, Turkey has invested considerable diplomatic and economic energy in sub-Saharan Africa. Though the continent is a small part of its total global trade, it's growing rapidly. Turkish economists say Ankara does nearly $10 billion worth of business with the region, double that if trade with North Africa is included. David Sheen is an adjunct professor in the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. VOA's William Eagle asked Ambassador Sheen, what are Turkey's main interests in sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, the same interest that every other major country has, including the United States and China, and that is to try to obtain the support of as many of the African countries as one can. Turkey has aspirations from time to time, for example, to be elected as a non-permanent member of the Security Council and the UN, and they need African support for that. Although it's a quiet issue now, there have been occasions when Cyprus has been a troublesome issue for Turkey, and it needs support outside of Turkey for its position on Cyprus. It's in economic fora, World Trade Organization, similar organizations where Africans are well represented. It's looking for a certain amount of support. So it's pretty much across the globe in terms of the issues that come up where the Africans have some influence and ability to help determine the outcome.
Does Turkey play a complementary role to Western interests in Africa, or at times does it also play a bit of a challenger?
In terms of Africa, I would say that the Turkish effort tends to be more complementary than it is competitive. Now, there will be obvious commercial competition that Turkey has with all major trading and investing countries in Africa, and that's normal. There's nothing unusual about that. In fact, to the extent that there is any competition between Turkey and other countries, it's probably more with countries like China and India than it is the United States and the European countries. And there is plenty of competition at that level. But in terms of what other countries around the world would like to see happen in Africa, including the United States, both politically and economically, that is in terms of economic development and political stability, I think the Turkish position is not significantly different than that of the United States. As a result, they're looking for economic development and indeed contributing to economic development in sub-Saharan Africa. I think they're also in favor of political stability. They have made a particular effort to reach out in the case of Somalia and arguably are playing the lead role in Somalia of any single other country. I think that's the only country in Africa where I would argue that Turkey has, in effect, the leading role, but it's playing an important role in places like Ethiopia, Sudan, and trying to extend its influence beyond that, although with some difficulty once you get beyond Northeast Africa.
You mentioned Turkish involvement in Somalia. What is the leading role there? Because we also mentioned, and you mentioned in your research, that, of course, al-Shabaab seems to have a very poor relationship with Turkey. There's a bit of enmity there. Does that not complicate matters for Turkey, at least on a diplomatic level, or being an honest broker in the Somali conflicts?
Well, Turkey you're right. Al-Shabaab poses a dilemma for anyone operating in Somalia who's trying to put an end, as it were, to the al-Shabaab movement, which includes the European countries, the United States, Turkey, China, many others. So to that extent, Turkey is facing pretty much the same situation that everyone else is facing there. It's just that they're more exposed on the ground than, say, the United States. I mean, they have far more people on the ground than the United States does. The role that Turkey is playing in Somalia, beyond trying to deal with the al-Shabaab threat, is to reconcile Somaliland and Somalia, and they've been playing the mediating role in that effort. For the time being, it's sort of at a hiatus, not really moving at all, and it's not clear that the talks are going to resume anytime soon. But if they do resume, it'll probably be under the aegis of Turkey, as the most recent talks have been. It's also playing a major developmental role in Somalia, in Mogadishu, and it has a diplomatic mission, a consular mission in Hargeisa, the capital of Somaliland, and it has an embassy with an ambassador on the ground in Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia. Turkish Air is the first major airline to start flying in and out of Somalia, and the leadership of Turkey has made several high-level visits to Mogadishu at a time when no other non-Africans were doing that. So they've put an awful lot into the Somali basket, and then you have civil society organizations that are very Turkish civil society organizations that are very active in Somalia. So when you add it all up, it's a major engagement by Turkey in Somalia.
David Sheen is an adjunct professor in the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle. A World Health Organization advisory group recommends continued clinical trials of a promising malaria vaccine to test its efficacy and safety. Separately, the Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization, or SAGE, is calling for the replacement of the current oral polio vaccine with another. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
More than 1 million people die of malaria each year. The vast majority are children in Africa. That is why the prospect of a vaccine to end the deadly toll is so exciting. While the first malaria vaccine, known as RTSS, shows promise, the SAGE advisory group says more studies are needed before it can be rolled out for use. The proposed vaccine works against the world's most deadly malaria parasite and the most prevalent in Africa. 4 doses are required for a child to be fully protected. The first 3 doses are given 1 month apart, followed by the 4th dose 18 months later. And that is where the main problem lies. Chair of SAGE, John Abramson, says the vaccine is about 30% effective in children who receive all 4 doses. But children who do not receive the 4th dose will lose their protection.
So there's no question we need 4 doses. The real question is how best to get these 4 doses in at times when we don't normally have a health care interaction with the child. So that is our main question, and is the reason we've asked for demonstration studies.
Abramson says SAGE recommends 3 to 5 large demonstration studies to be staged over several years, with about 1 million children taking part. He says the cost of the vaccine is about $5 per dose, making it one of the most cost-effective interventions. He notes the vaccine does not replace proven malaria control measures, saying it complements existing measures, including insecticide-treated mosquito nets, diagnostics, and treatment. SAGE also has decided to act on polio eradication. Only 38 cases of the crippling disease remain. Currently, oral polio vaccine is the primary tool used to eradicate polio. However, on very rare occasions, the live attenuated vaccine viruses contained in that vaccine have caused cases of paralysis among young children. As a result, SAGE recommends all countries using the trivalent oral polio vaccine should switch to the safer bivalent oral polio vaccine by May 1st, 2016. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to The Voice of America. For our listeners in Nairobi, Kenya, we'll be switching to a special program about the elections in Tanzania, which will take place on Sunday. Normal programming, however, will continue with the rest of our listeners across Africa and beyond.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, we follow up on Sunday's elections in Ivory Coast and Tanzania as votes are being tallied to determine who will lead both countries for the next 5 years. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests for an in-depth analysis on the elections. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk, turncoat. According to the dictionary, the word turncoat means a person who stops being a member of one group in order to join another group that opposes the first group. Do you want to know more? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing turncoat. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
song go better. Anything I say, you say. Anything I do, you do. Baby, mope, mope. I had a song go crazy. Baby, anything I say, you say. Anything I do, do, you do. Baby, mope, mope.
Music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. Simultaneously, I pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. This week, we have some very interesting observations with regard to U.S. policy in Africa. We cannot understand U.S. policy in Africa unless we contextualize our discussion with regard to American policy abroad. This is to say, United States policies towards other countries whose activities have implications for American interests, and they affect Africa and the rest of the world. Right now, the big issue of great importance to the United States in terms of foreign policy is what is happening in the Middle East. The relationship between the Syrian opposition and the government in Syria has implications for the United States and the U.S. relationship with the people in the Middle East. And this has consequences for Africa. If you really understand American policy towards Africa after World War II, you can see how the eruption of the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States affected the Middle East and Africa. And then the African governments that were coming into being, beginning with Ghana's independence with Kwame Nkrumah, and the bandwagon effect of decolonization in Africa. It is against this background we can now understand what is happening this week with regard to Russian activities in Syria against ISIS and the implication that has for U.S. policy towards Africa. The United States is very much involved in conflict resolutions, foreign aid, and a number of other issues. There are now over 3 billion Africans who are now living in the United States based on the statistics people are putting out with regard to recent African migration into the United States since the 70s. During the Cold War period, a growing number of Africans started coming to the United States. The great airlift which Tom Boyer brought to the United States in collaboration with the American government at the time, the same thing was done in Ghana. Kwame Nkrumah gave scholarships to a large number of Africans from small countries like Gambia and then going all the way to South Africa, to the point that you have some very interesting historical parallels which have implications for American-African relations, because those scholarship programs instituted in Africa at the time of decolonization of Ghana had implications all over the continent. All people who write about Pan-Africanism can tell you a lot about what I'm saying now. But in the interest of time, what we have to say is the events in the Middle East right now have great consequences for all of us. So with regard to how U.S. policy is affecting Africa and African opinions in Africa, we have to think about the Middle East stupid. The Middle East stupid. The Middle East stupid. Because the Middle East is a very dangerous zone for human history right now. Because the crisis in Syria has implications for Africans. There are many Syrian business people, Lebanese, who are traders from Mauritania all the way to Cameroon. And they are part of the African experience. The refugees who are fleeing to Europe may come to Ghana or Gambia or Senegal undetected, because people are focusing more about the Syrians fleeing to Europe, because that is more luxurious. But during the early period of the colonial period in 1900 and even before 1900 of West African history, many Syrians who couldn't make it to Canada or America or South America ended in West Africa. And this is the story of the Lebanese factor, Syrian factor in African politics. And that has implications for America. Many of the Americans who are Syrian and Lebanese joined the Peace Corps and ended up in Senegal, Ghana, and other parts of Africa. These are untold stories of the Lebanese and Syrian crisis and their implication for America and Africa. And some of our journalists, bloggers, and others should go to work and bring back this story. Thank you for the day.
And thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you give bad food to your stomach, it drums for you to dance. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa. We'll be right back.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years after ridding itself of Muammar Gaddafi's brutal regime, Libya is saddled with a divisive political struggle. In the eastern city of Tobruk resides the internationally recognized House of Representatives. A second political body, the General National Congress, is based in the west and controls the capital, Tripoli. The lack of a united, effective central authority has created a security vacuum that violent extremists and human smugglers have exploited. If the two sides fail to come to terms and establish a government of national accord, the consequences for Libya and its people could be dire. That is why the United Nations appointed a special representative of the Secretary General for Libya, Bernardino Leon, who was tasked with leading the Libyan political dialogue to develop a framework text agreement to create a unity government. After months of tireless negotiations among courageous Libyans on all sides, Special Representative Leon presented the final framework text to create a government of national accord in late September, and added on October 8th an annex that names the 6 members of the Presidency Council that will lead the unity government. Now it is time for Libyans to move forward and finalize the approval of the political framework text. As Secretary of State John Kerry said, if individual militias or individual leaders keep fighting for something other than Libya's interests, it will only help ISIL, and that is exactly what we are seeing happen. So it's critical for people to come together and shut down the possibility of extremists filling a vacuum. The United States urges the House of Representatives and the General National Congress to immediately and conclusively endorse the final framework text and the senior government of national accord leaders. As Secretary Kerry said, we cannot afford any more delays. It's imperative that all parties work to approve the final framework and fill the leadership positions for that government as soon as possible. And negotiations of the text is complete. The document is well balanced. It addresses the most basic aspirations of the Libyan people. We urge all Libyan leaders to come together to support the formation of the unity government, a government that will be representative, stable, and inclusive, and that will define the future of their country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.